My name is Fran. I'm an alcoholic. Well, we're going to roll the dice this morning, I'll tell you. We had a fire alarm that went off in the wing where we were in the hotel last night. I've never seen people in such outfits in my life, including my own, trying to pull a shorty thing down over my fanny, grab my dog, and wake up my deaf roommate. And I called the desk, and they said, we'll let you know if you evacuate, and I said, thank you. Got out in the hall. There was a couple that looked like a honeymoon couple, all dressed with a little bag, and I'm saying, don't look, you know. And so I got in, we got dressed. You should see somebody at 2 in the morning putting pantyhose on. It is just wild. I've had about 2 hours sleep. I don't know what's going to happen, you know. I'm really happy to be here. There is no way that I could get from where I was to here. No way. Thank you, Mike. You got a good machine. We talked last night. I talked to him once, but we had machines going back and forth. But I'd like to thank you all very much for having me here. When we walked into the room last night, or Friday, what is it, Sunday, Friday, there was a huge bouquet, a thing on the table, and had all this red cellophane, and it's a fruit basket. I thought, hot dog, we finally made it in AA. And then there was a bottle of Martinelli's sparkling cider in a nice thing, and two champagne glasses. I thought, well, all right. And I opened it, and I didn't have a can opener or a bottle opener. I thought, well, I'll try something from my little dog to open her dog food, and it didn't work so well. So I don't get rid of my old ideas. Those dressers have got marvelous handles. I took it over. I went, popped it. I thought, geez, you haven't done that in a long time. You know, but it's right there with you. So I sat down, and I poured it into a champagne glass, and I picked it up, and I sipped it, and I thought, Jesus, that feels funny. What is this, you know? And I said, you're getting quite civilized. And my way of doing it, if I had time, was to go to the bathroom, get a glass, and let's slug it, you know. And I feel like a six-year-old, trying on her mother's high heels and trying to walk. And I picked it up and I put it down. And I thought, see, I never really did that. I don't know anything about crystal. I look real nice, you know. I know how to do that. I am not a sherry sipper. I am a tough, hardcore, alcoholic dope fiend. Jelly glasses were beyond my means. I know there are some people with us that are younger who are coming in. What I'm going to do is tell my story, the journey of the outer person, and I want to tell you the journey of the inner person. I'll cry. There'll be lots to go on. I'm so old, I packed in so much, we're going to go over some of the dramatic parts, but my life has never been dealt. I was sitting there and I thought, they used to call me Sarah Bernhardt when I was a kid, and I said, well, here I am up on the stage. I did not expect it to be this stage. I did not expect to be here. Thank God I am. I am a miracle. And I'll tell you why. And I don't want to go through the childhood too much and all that stuff, but it laid the foundation, as Roger talked about, of what happened to me inside. I was, my mother died when I was 7. My father died when I was 9. And so I said, I'm an orphan. I used that for a long time. it's wonderful to be an orphan if it pays off. Until you get to be 58 years old in AA and they said, cut the orphan shit, you know. It's not paying off anymore. So I gave that one up. But I felt different. I was different. And I was raised by an aunt and an uncle who didn't want to have to raise me. They didn't expect to have to raise me. And they told me that. And I used to beg for them to love me, and they said, we can't do that. And I said, please want me to be here. And they said, we can't tell you that, because you see, I come from Yankee stock. I really think the heritage is from the Witches of Salem. I'm not sure, but I did the best they could. But, you know, you get up into the head trips, it's got to go from there into the gut. And so I'm just like Roger. You know, where in the world can you stand in front? I understand the registration here is almost 3,000 people. Now, where do you stand in front of 99% of you are strangers to me, and I'm going to tell you, stop, I didn't tell the priest in the confessional. I mean, you know, you've taught me so much about telling what's going on. You know, my sponsor is Tom W., from the People's Republic of Berkeley. And he's taught me a lot. And he'd say, well, how are you, Fran, in your weirdness? And I'd say, fine, I'm just fine. He'd say, that bad, huh? I said, well, Tom, you know, I work in mental health. And I said, even there, as you walk through the halls and somebody says, well, how are you? You don't say, well, what I'm experiencing today is some free-floating anxiety is what I'm experiencing today. I'm finding out that world's getting friendlier out there. But there's still things I don't go into out there that I go into here. Because, see, this is my life. I'm here because of my life. I'm here because there's no place else to go. And I'll tell you why. You will know it's no place, that this is the last place to go. So I grew up with the pieces not fitting, the emptiness of the soul, and I couldn't get it put together of where I fit or who I was or who am I? And I'm going to tell you, besides the people that saved my life, and I'm going to talk a little bit about God today, which I usually don't do, that you are God's glue for me. How do you like being called God's glue? I have what's called a fragmented ego. That means means you're not quite put together. And there's that emptiness and you can't fit in and you're searching a lot of places with a lot of people and doing a lot of things. As Roger said, you know, we're great addicts for approval. Somebody said that the other night. I thought, oh my goodness, the speakers are all saying the same thing. And I came in here exhausted, so tired, trying to be okay, that it was all right to exist. And so I set out in school by accomplishing a lot of things. I tend to go into homicidal competitiveness with men, too. And I went out for sports, and I'd bring these birdies home. I'd go get the scholarships, and I'd go get this, and I'd get on the swimming team, and I'd get on the basketball team. And I'd bring it home, and I'd say, now do you like me? Now is it all right? And they'd say, we don't know how you got that. And I'd go, shh, let's go out and get another one. If I did things, I'm not known for my anonymity, I gotta tell you. But if you're up there on the stage, if you work in television as I did, if you work in fashion as I did, if you did all these things, then will you show up and will you be there for me and will you tell me that you love me and it'll be all right? And they never did. Because you see, we come from Yankee stock. So if you tell her that that's all right, she'll wind up on the stage. Don't let her wear makeup because then something will happen. And it's craziness. And so then I was looking for some answers. I knew that some of the answers were a spiritual solution, but I didn't know where. I got a scholarship to a Jesuit university. My hometown is Detroit, Michigan. And I got some money to go to a Jesuit university. At my time, women were not very unusual for us to be educated by the Jesuits. They're men's educators, the cream of the crop, and there weren't many of us. And I never knew what they were talking about. I think, oh, there's got to be some. I still don't know what they're talking about. Tom's a Jesuit. Occasionally, I don't know what he's talking about, you know. And they recognized the hunger and the search. Because I knew there was a spiritual meaning to all of this, and I couldn't find it. So they said, you might be able to find some answers in the convent. Now you know that I'm not a cowering daisy. I'm very assertive. We don't say aggressive, we say assertive, healthy or something. And so I went into the convent and I thought, well, maybe this is going to be it. But I chose a cloister convent. I mean, that's where you don't talk. Me, I haven't shut up since I walked in this program. But we pray for you. Pray for your soul. My knees got sore and I don't know what that's doing. And so they said, we don't think that you're suited. And I said, oh, thank God. Oh, God. Thank you, Mother. Thank you. I really love to skip over this part because then you'll really kind of get a glimpse of what I'm really like. But I went from there and I went directly into the Navy. I'm a slow starter. I like the odds. I mean, that's pretty good odds. I still like men. I'm noted for that. Sober. And I had not had my first drink. I'm slow. I was scared. I knew they'd raise hell with me. I was scared about it. I don't know when I had my first drink. It was probably in the Navy. I went into the medical corps, hospital corps. I was a corpsman. I'd always wanted to be a nurse. They didn't want me to be a nurse, so naturally I got to be a nurse, corpsman, you know. And so I went in there, and I had my first drink in the Navy. I happen to not know anybody in the Navy who didn't drink. I'm not sure there's anybody in the Navy who doesn't drink. And I had beer, I guess. And I didn't like it. I've looked at this for many years, and it is really true. I did not like it. When it went down, it did not go home. I didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't like the way I felt, and I didn't like the way I got sick. And I didn't like what it did to women around me when I'd haul them into the barracks. And I've been known as being really very much of a snob, and I look down my nose at them. I'd be on duty in the dispensary at night, and I'd see sailors coming off liberty, and of course they're drunk. And I didn't think anything about that. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I've learned everything I've ever known about alcoholism here. All I knew is what happened to the liver. I knew when they fell through windows and shore patrol brought them in, get them in there, suture them up, try to keep them out of the brig, get them back to the barracks. And I had no judgment. I had no moral judgment of it. All I knew is the body. I just knew that I threw up a lot. I'd start dating. I didn't date until I went in the Navy. I don't know any woman in the Navy who's not going to date. The worst of us dated. And I'd go out with Marines. I love... It's called homicidal competitiveness, as I said. And I'd go out with Marines. We'd go to the Elk Club up in Bremerton, Washington. And there'd be another wave there with the group at the Elks Club there. And... we'd get up and excuse ourselves and go to the ladies' room. We always went together. I don't know. It's what we used to do. And I always thought we just did that to go in there to throw up. I didn't know why else we'd do all that. So it really hadn't been my drug of choice. It's what got me here. But I got hurt in the surge in the Navy. I worked in psychiatry, and I got thrown up against a wall, and it busted my back. And... they took me into surgery, and they gave me that first pre-op shot of Demerol. And in about 5 minutes, I said, hot dog. They ought to put that stuff up in fits. That did for me what I saw beer doing for you. We didn't have tranquilizers. We're talking World War II. We had phenobarb, and we didn't have the psychotropic drugs, and we used tepid baths and sheets on tubs and soft restraints and phenobarb. We didn't have the drugs that help settle people down. And so I got some, they gave me phenobarb. I'm a very nervous lady. I tend to find nervous doctors who understand my nervousness. And so they gave me some phenobarb, and I was on drugs for 26 years. And then we added the alcohol to it. Now, a man came across my path, of course. Big guy from Oregon, in the Navy, 6'6". Went over to China. We got engaged. He came back. We got married. And I'm like every woman of my generation, that everything would be okay with the little house and the wonderful husband, and we'd have two children and the picket fence, and I settled into that. And you know, because I think my father was an alcoholic, I'm not sure. He was an alcoholic. Of course, I'm enchanted with alcoholic men. I feel like magnets. I can pick them out at iMagnet. And if they have problems, we're married. That's it. I have in my entire life dated one non-alcoholic man. I thought I'd tried one that was kind of centered and kind of not like this and everything, and I was with him for about a half hour. I thought, I'm going to slap him. And we didn't drink. We were busy with the young life, etc. And we had a child, and she died. And I knew there were some problems in me, because I reacted and responded so harshly to this. And I went to work. I'd just like to get through that thing. We were married for 23 years, I was a corporate wife, RCA, Harry Crafter, Dumont, Fairchild, all that. We moved around the country, and we went up what we call the upward, we call them upward yuppies now, and then we called it upscale corporate life, bigger houses, this, that, and wound up in Dallas, Texas, which I love. I wanted to see some people from Texas. I didn't get a chance to talk to them. I loved it. I started my drinking in Dallas, Texas. And for 23 years, I beat on this man in every way, and I said, if you'll stop drinking, everything will be okay. I still kind of think that. Kind of makes sense to me if they'd straighten up. If you'll stop drinking, I'll be all right. We had two wonderful children. Dallas, Texas, the houses got bigger. Regional manager, had been a big football player, pro, and somebody mentioned Al-Anon to me. I said, will that fix him? Will that make him stop drinking? They said, no, you. I said, why me? I haven't got a problem. And I am a typical woman alcoholic. I'm a late bloomer. It was under there all along. I'll tell you what I've learned about addiction. It was underneath, and it was simmering. In the last 3 years, it was violent and unbelievable. He said, I can't be an alcoholic. I'm a big regional manager. I'm bringing home money, lots of it. You've got a beautiful home. The kids are in private school. What? I'm in a business. I'm in the communication fields, and we all drink in that area. In this business of communication, we all drink in it. I said, we'd come home, etc. Just get off my back. Join the human race. We moved to the Chicago area. And it was increasing, and I didn't see it. And he was shocked when he came home from work one night, and I was kind of wheedled out of it. And he wouldn't change, and it was getting worse, but he's going to work. He just didn't come home on certain nights. wouldn't be left alone, and I'd beat on him, physically. I tend to scream, I think I'm not getting through to you, or you don't understand English, or something. And this 6'6" guy, I'm hitting. You know, the second step, and I'm beating on him. Stop it. So I went to the liquor store. And I'd never been in a bar alone. I had never bought a bottle. We'd always have house parties. She'd take care of the booze. I took care of the food, etc. And I went in a liquor store, and I'd never poured a drink for myself. And I went in there, and I looked for J&B Scotch. And I saw it's what we drank. He would pour drinks for me at home. And I came home, and I slammed it on the kitchen table, and I said, "You want to see some drinking? You're going to see some real drinking, Buster. Let's go." And you see, by this time, I was his drinking buddy. And he liked it. But I was really starting to get into my alcoholism, and I didn't know it. He was the alcoholic, not me, because my idea was, if he could see what he was doing to me with his drinking, he had driven me to drink. Then when he saw the shape that what he was doing, then he'd stop, I'd stop, and we'd live happily ever after. But I got hooked. Within 10 days of buying that bottle, and this is all symptomatic of my disease, this behavior, within 10 days I was drinking a fifth to a quart of vodka a day, and did so for 3 years. He said, "You're worse than I am." And I turned out to be worse than he was. Now, there's a song of looking for all the answers in all the wrong places. Well, some of them are right places, you know. I got here because of where I went. I am a result of all this stuff and where I went. My family back east said, "There's something wrong with you. You're calling up drunk and you're doing all this stuff. And you've always wanted one thing, and we're going to give that to you. We're going to send you to Europe. You've always wanted to do that, and we want Stephanie, who was 17 years old at that time, to take you, be your caretaker." And so, I can't believe, we have arranged a private audience with Pope Paul for you, and maybe this will help you. I thought, well, maybe it will. You see, I knew I was alcoholic then, because I looked in the mirror, and I said, "You're an alcoholic. Who cares? I don't care. Where my alcoholism took me to, I am not a pretty drunk. I slug, as I told you before. I'm a hidden drinker. I'm an around-the-clock drinker. I am a morning drinker. And at the end, I had to have booze in the morning, and I would hang over the kitchen sink and pray to God that one slug in this 2-ounce mouth would stay down to stop the shakes. And it would come up, and I would rescue it and in a bowl and get it back down so we shouldn't waste it. I haven't been down there that long." And dear God, let it stay down. And the kids are saying, "Please, Mom, please, Mom." And I had to do it. And at the end, it didn't take that for the dry heaves to start. It would be taking off the cap of it, and I thought of it with the Martinelli and the fancy glasses. I'd take it off, and the dry heaves would start just from the smell of it. I'm at the very end curve of alcoholism. And so when they sent us to Europe, they were sending Pope Paul a heavy deal. And I didn't have a drink the night before I was to see the Pope. I don't think it's too cool to go see the Pope when you've been belting to. But I was up at 4 a.m. in Rome and looking out, seeing the bicycles going, and I said, "Don't drink, you're going to see the Pope." And there's St. Peter's Square, and there's the arches there, and right at the beginning, they didn't have the big building, this was in 1966. And there's Swiss guards there at the entrance, and huge marble stairway this wide going up into the Vatican apartments. And I had my engraved invitation, and the sweat was pouring off me. I hadn't had a drink since 4 that morning. It was about 10, 6 hours. And I loaded some more pills in, And we got there, and we went to the Swiss Guards, and we showed them the invitation. They used to drive horses up that marble thing up to the Vatican apartments, and I said to Stephanie, if I kneel in front of them and I can't get up, help me to get up. And we went into the consistory room, and it was all red brocade, and I love drama, man, I love drama. It was half of this one side section over here, the size of that. And I was sweating, and I thought, I should have had that drink. Suppose I have a fit. Well, he's the Pope. He should be able to take care of fits. And he came in with the Monsignors and the red and all that, and he talked in Italian for a while, and there were 16 of us there. And I'm so spiritual, all I could see was that he had big ears. Very, very big ears. And I got up to him when it was my turn, and he said, you have a problem in England. I thought, if he knew. Yes. And he said, pray. I thought, I have just traveled 6,000 miles. And I'm going back 6,000 miles, and that's it? And so I got home, and I went on a 10-day binge, and I didn't care, crawling on the floor, doing everything that women alcoholics talk about. I couldn't get out of the house. And so, I made the call. I don't know how. There were no treatment centers. In Western Springs, Illinois, outside of Chicago, I opened up the book. I was looking for another hospital. Because you see, I've had 37 surgeries. And the way I run is I get sick. And I was looking for another hospital. Hospitals I know. And for some reason, I had known that I was alcoholic. And for some reason, I knew if we could put the chemicals down, there was a chance of leaving the black hole of hell and going back to the gray life. But there would be no white life for me. It was too late. I tried too hard. That would not but get me out of hell. The despair and the loneliness and everything that every alcoholic that's been where I've been knows. But maybe it could, but I couldn't stop drinking. I knew I couldn't, but I knew that's what AA did. I just knew you telephoned, and I don't know how that stops me. Lock me up, maybe. But how do you do this? And it was in the Yellow Pages. And I called, and it was Intergroup in Chicago. And they said, we'll be there. Just stay in there. And at that time, they came in squads. With some of the people I sponsor, that makes sense. And they came in fives because they stayed around the clock for you, with you. And the kids said, thank God, when they came home from school and the people were there. And they detoxed me in my bed. They brought a doctor who was in the program to give me a vitamin shot. And he took one look and he said, what the hell are you taking? And when you are surrendered, you tell the truth. And I said, I have been drinking a fifth to a quart of vodka a day, have been for 3 years. I take 15 to 25 tranquilizing and sedating pills, and I've been shooting morphine twice a day for 6 months. And I went cold turkey with them. At the end of 5 days, they hauled me into a meeting, but I did look good. And I love this program. And I loved you. God, how I loved you. I knew there was something very special here. I knew it. I dissected the steps. I knew Sermon on the Mount. I'm very educated. I knew St. John. I knew the value of catharsis. I knew the value of cleaning it up, and I loved it. I had 10 days sobriety, And it was Friday night, and Peter Gunn was coming on, and I got the vibes. I got the Al-Anon antenna. I got to a meeting, and he came home about 10 o'clock, and I'd come home from the meeting, and he was drunk. And he said, any comment? Now, I've been a member of Al-Anon for 23 years. I need it. Believe me, I work in codependency. I hate to tell you that. I react to people's behavior. I respond to circumstances and people's behavior, and I was scared. I drank at his drinking. They told me that at my first meeting. You're drinking at him. And he came home and he was drunk, and he said, any comment? And I said, only one. He said, I knew it. I said, only one. I have found something very special. There was something in that AA that is beyond not drinking, and I haven't had a drink for 10 days. And I don't know how, but there's something going on in there. And I'm going for it. And you can do what you want to do. I love you, but I'm going for it. And the next morning he called and said, how do you join AA? And I called the guys. Now, we moved to Laguna Beach. Chuck Chamberlain helped get me sober. You've heard a lot of his name this week. I am a Chamberlain baby. It was a deep pocket of spirituality and activity. And we got there and went to meetings. They were straight with me. They would not let me have the book. They said, you're all up in your head. Just go to meetings. Shut up. I've never shut up. And they said, keep coming back. They did not suggest. They said, we do tell some people to come back one day at a time. With you, we're going to say you come back for the rest of your life, or we'll kill you. And I got drunk every 3 months. And I didn't know why. I took the steps. I wrote them. I went to Chamberlain. I had Elsa as my Al-Anon sponsor. I spoke. I never stopped going to meetings. I did everything I knew. I never missed a meeting except the 3 times I drank. He would drink when I'd get sober. I'd get sober, he'd drink. Out on the road, called the shift of family equilibrium in the field, what I say is we got drunk. And he came home and everything was going well. We had a beautiful home in Corona Del Mar. The kids were in Alateen. I was getting sober. I'd made my amends to him. That who was I to judge the things that had happened in the course of alcoholism in the marriage that was killing me? The stuff that goes on in an alcoholic marriage. And I drank behind it and I couldn't stand it. And he came home one night and he said, let's go to a meeting. And he was a big shot in Los Angeles and we had a gorgeous home and a lot of money. And the cabana and the guest house and the works in Corona Del Mar. And he came home and he said, I don't feel good. He went to the back to get a Tums and I went back and he was on the dressing room floor and he'd had a cardiac. And I called the paramedics and I called Dr. Paul who was at the Broadway Canyon Club. Come. And somebody got a priest and they worked on him. And I got on my knees. And I said, I thought I could beat booze. On my terms, I wanted AA and I wanted the right to drink the way I wanted to drink. And I said, but we're looking at life and death. I've done everything I can do. He's either going to make it or he's not going to make it. And thy will be done. And he died. And he was 44 years old. And he'd never been sick a day in his life. And I got up, and it was all right. And I lost the house, and I lost all the material things, and I had 2 kids. And I said to Chuck, what happened? Why do I know it's going to be all right? He said, because you were surrendered. And so I started to look at that. And for me, I have found out it is a phenomenon that occurs, as Dr. Tebow said. That when the pain in my life equals the pain that I am able to endure, that it tips me over. And I had taken the 3rd step when I said, thy will be done, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. I will spin in that corner, I'll do anything you tell me to do. And they came and they surrounded me. And they said, don't drink. And Paul said, no pills. I said, no, I won't, I won't. I couldn't stand the pain of drinking on top of the pain of the loss, and it matched my tolerance, and it was my bottom. And I thought it would last. And Chuck says, oh no. This is a spiritual problem with a spiritual solution. Once we stop drinking and we get the addiction under control, it is a spiritual problem with a spiritual solution, and you come back because you're going to go through many plateaus of surrender in sobriety. I thought once I was surrendered that the ego had been deflated at great depth, but my ego is like crabgrass. It just goes, wah, wah. And there we go. So, I lived on benefits, veterans and Social Security, for 2.5 years. And I never missed a meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. When I surrendered, it's been 22 years. A miracle. And I haven't had a pill, except when they put me in the hospital and they have to do stuff, which they've done in sobriety. But I was surrendered. I said, I'll do what you tell me to do. And they healed me and they loved me back to life. Now, I'm not exactly calm. I never stopped talking from the minute I got in here until today. I promised somebody that I would, I got a lot of people that I'm going to tell you about today that I promised things to. For my own humility, which I'm not sure that we handle real well. I was 2.5 years sober, and I got married in Tijuana at an Orange Crush stand or an upholstery shop, and I couldn't understand why my sponsor didn't attend the wedding. And it lasted 6 weeks, and it was annulled. God, that takes a lot to tell you that. At the end of 3 years, they said, you better go to work. You are so into yourself. But they threw me into service. They threw me into H&I and GSR, and I ran and ran and ran. And they said, you got to go to work. You got no more money. You're running out of benefits. The kids were in school, but you're running out of benefits. I said, me work? I work for fancy stuff, like Dallas Trademark, and get a client in there and make the profit and buy me a beautiful piece of furniture. You mean you? I have to put go to? I still stumble on this. You mean go to work to pay the rent? They said that's it. And God was good, because I went to work for the welfare department in Orange County. Now, the reason this is God's work is because 8 years ago, I was in the welfare department line as a client. And then I moved over to community mental health when Regan was emptying out the hospitals, and I'm a dope fiend, and I got 4 years of sobriety, and went over to community mental health, and we put some drug teams together. And they asked me to come on over there because I was a recovered dope fiend alcoholic, and I knew the welfare system. And I had a staff of all Synanon people. And I've been in Synanon the games. The only place I learned how to put four-letter words together in sequence, it never quite came out right. It did in the games. So I have to watch myself today, since this is spiritual need. And we have to game before we staffed. And then a man came across my path. And he was recovered 5 years. And some of you up here have heard him years ago. He was a physician, a pathologist, the science guys. He was in a psychiatric residency, 5 years sobriety. He had an IQ of 182. It is kind of like, are we in reality? What are you talking about? Just, but I get turned on by intelligent men. They're good looking, I'm done. And he was a big speaker in AA at big conferences, and he was funny. And we got married, and he was schizophrenic. And we had 10 years of insanity. But to acknowledge him, some of you here in Sacramento know my son Tom, who went to meetings here for 5 years when he was at Davis in veterinary school. And because of Lou Smith, Tom became a veterinarian after Lou moved his family into AA. And Tom came up here and had a spiritual experience when he learned how to take the steps and did it exactly as it was said to do it. And he had hepatitis. And he and Ben knew him. Bob knew him. And he didn't get in. He got his degree in psychology sober. He's going to work in alcoholism, naturally. Sober 20 minutes, we're going to be in alcoholism. And he said, that doesn't work. And Lou said to him, which I later used, 8 years ago I did this, he said, you search your innermost heart as to what you want to do, and you love doing it. And you serve God and his fellow man, and you do it for fun and for free because you want to, and all else will come forth. And Tom said, I want to be a veterinarian, but I can't. Tom, wait a minute. Put the footwork in to learn your craft. So Tom went back to school and put in 2 years of science. 1 year, got into Davis, almost didn't get in. He was turned down to get into Davis to even put more time in before 4 more years in the vet school, 16 times harder than medical school. And he got turned down and he sat down, and I love the guy, Les, I said, write a letter. But Tom said, I'm going to go back and I'm going to talk to them and I'm going to tell them the truth about me. Because he'd been a flop in school, and then all of a sudden he got all A's. What is this? You know, you're a flop here, and he'd been a flop in school, and then all of a sudden he got all A's. What is this? You know, you're a flop here, and what? I'm going to go back and tell him. What I'm going to go back and tell him is, I'm a liar, cheat, and I love drugs. Can I hang around your pharmacy for 4 years? He's coming back here. He loves it here. He has 15 years of sobriety. My daughter, Stephanie, has 15 years of sobriety. She's a psychiatric nurse. She's an artist with a degree. We're very close. Tom met Jan up here in Sacramento, and maybe I'll discuss the 13th step. I know that one. He met her here in the meetings in Sacramento. She was a newcomer. He liked newcomers. He'd say, get them before they learn anything. He was active in the primary purpose group here, and they got married, and they've been married for 8 years. She's the baby in the family. I guess Jan's got about 9 years. She loves it here. She'll be back. Stephanie met Jim at a young people's meeting in San Francisco. We lived in Grass Valley for a while. We were in San Francisco for R&R from him. And she met him. My son-in-law has 20 years sobriety. He's my buddy. He's the one I call immediately, usually about men. We're close. Things have turned around. Tom did not like me for a long time. The program works miracles. I adore my children. Lou had a hard time with drugs. The rationalization that Benadryl is an antihistamine, and I'd say, but why using 8 at night? Well, I have a bad allergy.
Oh.
You can go to sleep on this. I called Elsa, and I tell her what was going on with the schizophrenia and this rationalization of using certain things, and she said, too heavy for me. Thanks, Elsa. And I stayed sober. And then 8 years ago, I knew he was going to die. And we lived, if he was the medical director, the executive director of a huge state hospital in California. And we lived in a 14-room house. And I was the H&I that got AA. It took us 15 years to get Alcoholics Anonymous into the criminally insane, who I like to work with. I like to work with the criminally insane behind fences. We have a curious understanding of each other. And has to do with the exquisite ability to manipulate. And I said, I got it. They know I got it. We're through that. And then we work together. I said, takes one to know one, so let's get off and let's get on with it. We got an Alcoholism and Treatment Center in this big hospital, got it in behind the fence, and I like working with him. And he was the big director, and we had a big 14-room house and all the help, and one more time, lots of money and property and prestige. You see, my thing is, when I was young, is if you do things and you get the approval, you get the recognition, I'm okay. Well, that didn't work. I got tired of that. And so then I had to have things. If I have the big houses, the big cars, the furniture, the clothes, the stuff, then I'm okay. Do or have. I didn't know anything about being. That I thought that was being. And so 8 years ago, I came home and he had been using, and I knew he was going to lose his arm. And I said, I'm leaving. I have to leave. I love you, but I can't live with this. And I see pictures of myself and my head looks like a skull. And I got the guys. Go get them. They put him in treatment. And at the same time, I had to have my leg amputated. And I came to San Francisco to have it done. My husband was in treatment. I'd never been through treatment. I work in it, but I've never been there. And I had to have the leg taken off. And I didn't use drugs for 10 years, or 10 months, when I had a huge ulcer on it. I used a TENS unit and meditation and acupressure and acupuncture, and I screamed a lot. And I beefed up my meeting. I was scared. I'm scared of drugs. And so that's how I got to Northern California. And I went back to see if it would work. I was in the hospital for 6 months, Ralph K. Davies. And I went back and he was damaged. And I've been abused a lot, not just by him, but by everything, my environment, my family, a lot of emotional abuse. And I said, I have to go. I love you. And so my daughter offered me refuge in her basement in Daly City. Now, I'm talking about a basement. Basement. This had no view. It was cinder block. And when I left with $13. My little dog, Bear, who's here with me, her 2 one-day-old puppies, a borrowed car, and a box of food 8 years ago. And they got me in the basement with the furnace and the exposed toilet. And I sat on a sofa because there wasn't room for a bed. And I said, is this what the hell 14 years of sobriety is about? And the pain was so great in here. I have a half a stomach. I've had 7 bleeding ulcers. Everything goes to my gut. And it hurt so badly. I said, isn't there something I can take to make it go away? I can't stand this kind of pain. And I said, no. They said no. And I crawled. I didn't have a prosthesis that worked, and I fanny bumped my way up, and I called the Westgate meeting, and I said, come and get me. I haven't used, but I'm new. I saw Cy down here at San Francisco meetings when I went over there, and I did what I could do. And many times I went in on crutches. You ought to have one leg and be on a crutch. And they were good to me. And the kids loved me. And my daughter came down, and I said, I thought it was because you were a psychiatric nurse. She said, give me more credit than that. It's because I love you. And she came down and she said, we will not allow you to be a victim or a cripple. You will go to work or you'll go to school. You will not sit here because you'll die and you will pay rent. I said, with what? What? Well, it was easier. It's always easier for me to go to school than go to work. So I went back to San Francisco State. They had a program for seniors, reentry, urban reentry, if you can academically. So I did what I said to Tom. I said, search your deepest heart. What are you going to do there? I said, I have two loves, fashion and psychology. And they said, oh, great. And I went to Voc Rehab. I mean, you either know the system or you don't. And my brother, who's my cousin, sent me a car. He inherited it all out of his own guilt or other. He's a great guy, though. He sent me a car and he said, I'm going to give you wheels. I'm going to give you legs. And he got me in a little electric wheelchair out in that tower out there to get through the campus and go for it, baby. And I did. And I went to Voc Rehab. And I said, I'm eligible for some money. I'm going to help you with my case. I'm a female, so I'm a minority, right? I mean, they get kind of glazed looks. I said, and I'm a senior citizen. I'm an amputee. How do you like that? I'm an amputee. Some word they faint when you say amputee. And it's service connected. If I was ethnic, I could run for mayor. I need money for materials and books and gas and... They said, what are you going to make? I said, what is your... And I don't care, just tell me, I'll do it. I knew what I was going to do. And I went for it. And then I had to put my own business together. And I did it. I moved over to Marin County. I mean, God is good. If you're in trouble, go to Marin County. They don't have many like us that need help. And I went there. Now, I want to tell you a couple of exciting things that happened to me. I come from Laguna Beach, as I told you. It is a very heavy pocket of AA. And I got a call from somebody who said, we got the idea that we're going to take Alcoholics Anonymous into the Soviet Union for the first time. And we need you. You're up there in Northern California. We don't know anybody in Northern California. We want to get to the consulate. Will you be on our committee? And I said, sure. So they came up. Some of them, the founder who had the idea, we went to the consulate, and that didn't work out real well, etc. It took a year and a half, almost 2 years, to put this thing together, observing the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and working with New York. And I did all the medical liaison work, because Moscow Ministry of Health wanted to know, who are you? Is it a cult, or is it medical? So I got to Dr. Joe Taccamini, who is a non-alcoholic. He's been very active with alcoholism and totally condones AA and Al-Anon. And I said, Joe, who is also the chairman of the drug committee of the American Medical Association in Washington, D.C., can you get a letter of approval from the AMA as to what Alcoholics Anonymous is? I said, sure, where's it going? I said, the Ministry of Health in Russia. He said, where? I said, Russia. He said, sure. Took 3 months, he got their permission, he photocopied everything about alcoholism, and that the AMA says Alcoholics Anonymous is the most efficient and most helpful form of treatment that the AMA knows, and also Al-Anon. And it went over to Russia. And they said, good, we'll let you in. And I thought my work was done, and they said, oh no, you're going with us. And they invited me, and they said, they've never seen a disabled alcoholic who's sober. Well, I said, thank you. And so we left, and our primary purpose was to have the first open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Soviet Union. New York knew. We checked with them thoroughly about the traditions as to how to do it, and when we left, and we gathered from all over the country, and we gathered in Helsinki, Finland, and had an orientation meeting, and there were 30 of us, 29 alcoholics, one Al-Anon. And New York said, good luck. And we held the first meeting in the Soviet Union in Kiev on April 10th, 1986. And I went with a wheelchair and Canadian arm crutches and a cane and a backpack, the fashion maven of the world, And I went. And people asked certain questions. What'd you do about God? Well, we were going to have that first meeting, so we went through the format and said, what are we going to do? My God, what are we going to do? And we held it in an English-speaking junior college where there were about this many people, and we were up here in a circle. And we decided to have the format, read the 12 steps, read the traditions, and have a young speaker. We found out there were too many of us with too much white hair and too much sobriety. They wanted the young people. That's the hope of their country. And so we said, what are we going to do about God? Do we say the Our Father? I said, oh, we're talking like we always do about newcomers. Don't mention God. We'll scare them off. Well, they said, well, this is a godless country. So because we did it with vote, we decided we would end the meeting with the Serenity Prayer, not the Our Father. So then the vote was, you ought to be with a bunch of alcoholics doing all this. And they said, so what are we going to do? Say, God grant me the serenity. These are people with 20, 30 years of sobriety. Yeah, are we going to say, God grant me? Or should we say, please grant me the serenity? And I was the only one from Northern California. We were from Texas and Alaska and Washington and Idaho and Louisiana and New York, all over the world, the country. And I voted, had to vote for you guys. And I voted for God. So we get in there, and we start the meeting. Now, we had never heard Steve's story. And we hoped they did not understand what he was saying. We said, oh my God, oh Lord. And we ended it, and we had a meeting, and they were listening, and they were watching. And so then we got up, and we said to them, would you join us in the Serenity Prayer? And they said, sure. They were wonderful to us. They were wonderful. And we all gathered, and we all held hands. And we said, we are now going to say the Serenity Prayer. We'd had a meeting. We were right in the rhythm. You know what happens when we come into a meeting. And so the leader said, we will now say the prayer, and we said, God grant me the serenity, when please had been one in the vote. We lost in the vote and we won in the meeting. And I said, hot dog, we got God into the Soviet Union. Now I'd like to tell you what they think about alcoholism. They know it's a disease. They know that it means you do not take a drink. They don't know how. We went into narcological hospitals. That's what it's called. All we wanted was some Russian drunks. And me, I wanted a woman. Give me a Russian woman. And we went into one in Moscow, and it was locked, and they were waiting for us. Locked doors, and alongside the door was a bench. And the attendants were sitting on the benches, and they were women in the white things with the white pinafores and the baker's hat. I looked at them, I said, I'll never drink again. They weighed about 400 pounds. I thought, gee, that's scary. They got it. The doctor there had started one alcoholic helping another. They said, we don't believe you. We see your eyes. One old goat said to me, where'd you get your 22-year-old eyes? I said, from them. They said, why do you keep saying you're an alcoholic? I said, when does it go away? They know not to take a drink. They were suspicious of us at first. We sat in many rooms with long mahogany tables and silver trays and the soda water. And they'd ask us a question, and they'd talk. But they asked us one question I'd like to share with you. They'd say, what is AA? Who are you? And we had to put some semblance of order to it. And so when they said, who are you? What are you? Igor would stand up. We always had translators. And we always had Igor do this. And he said, my name, and he was allowed me to do this. He said, my name is Igor Sikorsky. And I'm an alcoholic. an American alcoholic. And my father invented the helicopter. And it is hanging in your museum in Moscow. And I know your country very well. But I'd like to tell you who you are. Now imagine that you're sitting in Moscow, and their shoulders are up tight, and they don't know who these Americans are. Glasnost had not even started in 1986. And he would read, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues, no fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, the shoulders of the band. Organization or institution does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And they got it. Now, when some people asked me at this meeting, because we were all allowed to speak a little bit, and I said, I would like to tell you one thing. It has worked for me. I am a helpless, hopeless, tongue-chewing, babbling alcoholic, as Chuck used to say. But there will be an international conference in Seattle in 1990. And at the opening ceremony, from what I have always seen, is that each country walks in with the flag of their country, and they go up to the microphone, and they say, let it begin with me. I said, if you walk in with that red flag, with the hammer and sickle on it, they will go crazy. And they said, no. I said, don't you see? If you do, it means your country is recovering with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, oh, we'll see. I'd like to tell you now that the book has been published in Russian, translated by an American who is in Finland who went with us. There is some literature put together, and since 1986, there are now 30 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Moscow. It's not new anymore. 500 alcoholics have gone over there now. They got it. I came back and I talked a lot about it. What I discovered about going over there is very dramatic, and it was a privilege. And I wanted it as a heritage for my children. And what I found out was how to practice the traditions in a personal manner. Not just for the group, but for me. And what I saw with the alcoholics was how much they wanted to carry the message. And how much that they got out of the drama, and they were totally interested in how to behave. Because of just carrying the message, and how much they anonymously helped me. Texans are great about grabbing you in the back and throwing you up into rattle trap buses and break down my wheelchair, and I never knew who was pushing me. And I saw them practicing their program, and that's what I came away with it, with that behavior of my fellow alcoholics and their integrity. And I stopped talking because I suspected I had cancer, and I've had cancer twice since then. I don't know if you've heard this Eskimo story in AA. Bobby Earle used to talk about it. I've had lots of Eskimos. It's those people that you bump into, that run across your path, and you think, where the hell did they come from? The Eskimo story is that there were two alcoholics sitting in a bar in Seattle, and one believed in a higher power and the other one did not. And the believer said to the non-believer, hi, where have you been? I haven't seen you for a while. He said, oh, I've been up in the Yukon. And the believer said, well, what happened when you were up there? He said, you know, I really thought about you when I was up there, you and your higher power. He said, I was up there and the storm came up and I had my dog sled and the dogs and the snow came and the blizzard came and I couldn't see in front of me, I couldn't see behind me. And he said, I thought of you. I thought, ah, this is, maybe he's got something going for him. So he said, I got down on my knees and I said, do something, make a light, do something, strike it with this, part the snow, you know, help me. And he said, I knew it didn't work. Nothing happened. I didn't get the snow parting. And he said, and I passed out and I knew you and your higher power didn't work. And the believer said, well, how did you get here? And he said, oh, some old Eskimo came along and dragged me into his dirty igloo. And he was the Eskimo. And I would like to tell you about one of the Eskimos in my life. This is a very special man in my life. I hear a lot of you people saying, I love myself. I mean, oh my God. Oh my God. How do you do that? I knew I was healed by you. I knew you were God's glue. I came in here as a very selfish, self-centered woman. When people got up and got their birthday cake, as they do in Southern California, I didn't care if they got a birthday cake. I want the cake. I didn't care. I had about 2 years sobriety, and I saw somebody get a cake that had come on when I came in, and I was very glad. I thought, you just might have a chance. Now, for 20 years since then, I have learned to give. You told me to give. It gets very easy to give. It is very easy when you are around here and people say, I love you, I love you. You'd say, Mr. Yankee, and you say, thank you, thank you. Nice, it's really nice. What has been very hard for me is to let real deep, deep, meaningful love get through the crack in my heart. I never knew this. We do not get all the answers. I have said, maybe I'll have it made when I die, and they dig the hole, and they put me in, and they put the dirt on top of it, and they put the daisies on top, and they'll have a tombstone, and they'll say, here lies Fran, straightened out at last. I have never said, I love myself. You see, I learned a long time ago that it's bad to feel good. You see, I come from a background that says, if you feel bad, it's good. If you suffer, if you're sick, that it's all right. And I'm not putting the Catholic Church down. But the mea culpa, I am unworthy that you should enter under my roof. I've been told that all my life and I bought it, covered up by a lot of this bravado stuff. But I could never say that. A bolt would come. I heard about purgatory and hell and heaven. Well, I didn't think I'd go to hell. But I thought purgatory was like a big room with benches on the side and we'd sit there and get called to go somewhere. I'm very dumb. I don't understand, have not understood all this God's got. I did not understand about how it could be a power out there. And then they say, if you want to find the real reality, look within yourself. Well, how can he be out there and in here? How can I turn it over to me when I got to turn it over to them? Or whatever. You're the power. I saw the God in you long before I saw the God in me. I'd come in here and get the power. I still do. And I take it and I put it in my pocket. And then I go on out there. Then I come back and I get the power out there. When somebody first said to me, the God is within yourself, I said, not in here. I'd kind of go, where is it in here? Somebody said, you know, I've been with the Cherokee Indians. I really hate to tell you all about this. I fly and I'm going to ride a horse and And I've been up in the Cherokee Nation because I go up into the mountains in northern Georgia. I'm tired. I've been going up there for 8 months now. And there's a Cherokee Nation and nobody's getting well. But there's an old Indian story that talks about the mime who stands in the light. And what he means is that he lost himself. You see, that's what alcoholism did to me. I lost myself. It was there. And I looked for it in all the wrong places. And so when this mind and this light lost it, he looked out here for what it was he lost. And somebody said, it's in the light. It's right there. And a dear person in my life said to me, why is it that when you're up there on the podium in AA, you are in the light? And then when you get down, you lose it. And I said, what is it I lose? He said, and this is a promise, and I'm going to gag, but I'm going to do it. He said, why do you lose your wonderfulness? Why can't you say you're wonderful? You're not handling humility very well. Your life is only one side of the coin. The world is two sides of the coin. It's good and it's bad and it's beautiful and it's ugly. But unless you know the godliness in you, you are putting down God. That got me here. He said, let me tell you something about being wonderful and what it means. It means being full of wonder. The wonder of seeing sobriety. The wonder of seeing you. The wonderfulness of breathing life into life. And he said, I want you to tell him, you're wonderful. I am telling you, I am wonderful. And you are wonderful. A year ago, I spoke in London. Only because I sponsor people. Yeah. You know, I said, come on over. They sent me a ticket. I went to London to speak. And I asked my daughter and my son-in-law to take me. I'd gotten another Veterans Award. They went with me, and we went back to the Vatican 22 years after I was sober. And I looked up the steps. And the guide said, do you have an invitation? I said, no. I don't need an invitation. Great Pope, I guess. You see, I found God's kids. And he smiled. And from there we went to Paris. And 23 years ago, I walked into Sacré-Cœur, where my family had sent me to do something to help me. And I went into Sacré-Cœur, and there they don't just have votives. I just love the French. I mean, they do it my way. They had huge tapers. And I'm very Catholic, so I was lighting the taper. 23 years ago, I lit that taper, saying, please help me. I can't stop drinking. I can't get sober, and I can't get drunk, and it's not working, and I'm drinking for relief, and I am in a living hell. All I can do is pass out, and it's not working anymore. Please help me out of this insanity. I don't know if I'm crazy or alcoholic or drug. I cannot stay where I am. And I am in absolute torture, and I lit the taper, and I put it there. And last year, I went back, and the kids were smart enough to leave me alone, and I went in, and it was a dark chapel, and it was empty. And I went up to the same thing that had the tapers, and I pulled out a taper, and I lit it. And I said, thank you. And then I pulled out a second one. I'm going to do another one. And I lit it, and I put it there, and I said, this is for them. That was for you. I thank you for my life.